For another perspective on where we are and where we're headed in ovarian cancer, I met with Dr. Ursula Matulonis, who began our discussion by commenting on treatment strategies now being evaluated in ongoing clinical trials.
For upfront disease and newly diagnosed patients, most of the studies have focused on women who have advanced cancer, so either stage 3 or stage 4. Very few studies are looking at stage 1 and stage 2, predominantly because they're not that common. You know, the majority of women are still diagnosed with stage 3 and stage 4 disease. There's an ongoing gynecologic oncology group study that is looking at carboplatin plus paclitaxel with or without Avastin upfront. So that's the first randomization. It's a placebo study, so women and doctors don't know what they're getting. And then in the maintenance phase, there's a second randomization. Either they're randomized to placebo or to Avastin. And that includes women who have stage 3 and stage 4. Recently changed also to include patients who have optimally debulked cancers to try to really enhance accrual on this trial. And I was just at the GOG meetings last week, and accrual now is actually going pretty well. There is a decision that's just been made that when women go on the maintenance portion of this, either Avastin or no Avastin, that's given for approximately a year later, if they progress during that maintenance phase, they were not unblinded. So if you're on placebo and you came off trial, you didn't know whether or not Avastin made sense to go on or not. So that is in the process of changing. So patients will now know, doctors will now know if patients are on placebo or on Avastin. That's going to be a very important study. And that will change downstream treatment in terms of recurrence and maintenance if the study is positive. And again, there's no indication at this point whether or not that study is positive or not. And again, the primary endpoint of that trial is progression-free survival.
What about safety data?
No, we do not have any safety data. No. The data will be looked at initially in the spring of 2009 to look at any difference in PFS. And at this point, there's not been a large safety signal that has caused the closure of the trial.
Now, are you putting patients on the study?
We do not. We have some GOG studies. What we have our own Dana-Farber Harvard Cancer studies in-house.
So what would you generally put a patient on?
So we, at this point, if patients are optimally debulked, so they have a centimeter or less of residual cancer at the completion of surgery, we'll place them on either standard of care, which, again, we can talk about, is either Carbotax or intraperitoneal cysts plus Taxol. But our two trials are either intraperitoneal carboplatinum and IP Taxol with IV Avastin. And those are for patients who have stage 3 cancers, optimally debulked. All other patients, we have a trial that uses carboplatin, Taxol, plus Avastin. And then once they've completed their 6 cycles of chemotherapy, they're randomized to either Avastin or Avastin plus erlotinib. And that's about halfway done, this particular study, all phase 2.
I want to track out the thinking behind these studies, but I have to ask you to brief me a little bit on erlotinib and ovarian cancer and the rationale for that combination.
So there is data in other tumors for Avastin and erlotinib. Erlotinib has some minor single-agent activity in recurrent cancer. There may be some synergy between the two drugs. The other rationale is that there's high levels of EGFR expression on ovarian cancer cells. So that's the rationale. And again, with the thought that when you're treating somebody after chemotherapy and in maintenance, that you have small volume disease. So you wouldn't expect a drug like erlotinib to do much if someone's got a large volume recurrence. But in the maintenance setting, there may be some antiangiogenic effects of erlotinib that could combine or perhaps synergize with Avastin. So that's the rationale for that.
What do you say to a patient or, for example, a referring community doc about the issue of perforation with bevacizumab and ovarian cancer, both in terms of what we know in advanced disease and what we think in terms of earlier disease?
Right. So I think probably the reasons for the perforation may be slightly different. Again, this is not based upon any data, but just from what we've seen in patients who have newly diagnosed disease versus recurrent disease. In newly diagnosed patients, you really have to have some bowel problem. So in other words, a point of reanastomosis. So somebody has a bowel resection as part of their upfront surgical management, and they have a piece of intestine removed. At that point of anastomosis, that is a possible point of perforation. Sometimes that can be asymptomatic. I've seen that happen on CT scan, and you see a little tiny pocket of air that probably microperf, and it walled off, and patient never even knew about it, all the way to a full-blown perforation that develops into a peritonitis. I've certainly seen both of those. In patients with recurrent disease, the bevacizumab risk of GI perforations happens more in patients with chemotherapy refractory disease. And in the study that our group did that was published in the JCO now about a year ago, we found that the risk of perforations happened if you had more rounds of chemotherapy. So if you had three or more trials of chemotherapy, those patients had a higher risk of recurrence. And that's the 11% of risk of GI perfs that's been reported.
Although I assume those patients who've gotten a lot of chemo also would be more likely to have a lot of tumor in their belly.
Exactly, exactly.
Do you think it's just a marker for that, or is it the chemo?
There's not really a marker for that. I think the way I rule out patients for bevacizumab for recurrent disease are those who have a lot of bulky peritoneal disease that's sitting on bowel, and those patients have a lot of symptoms of difficulty of eating, they have some indigestion. I would think twice about putting somebody on bevacizumab.
Can you summarize what your take is of the available clinical research reports about Bev and advanced disease with ovarian cancer?
Mm-hmm. So now there have been three trials looking at Bev in recurrent ovarian cancer. A GOG trial in patients who had platinum-resistant and platinum-sensitive disease. A Californian study that looked at Bev plus oral cyclophosphamide. And then the trial that we did here within the DFHCC that looked at single-agent bevacizumab in a different patient population. And those are patients who are platinum-resistant, and they had to have either been Doxil or topotecan resistant as well. So a very specific group of patients who had very chemotherapy refractory disease. In the GOG study, they saw a few perfs, but certainly not the 11% that we saw. And their response rates are around 19%. So in a patient population with recurrent ovarian cancer, a 19% response rate is actually very good. In the Californian group, when you add oral Cytoxan, and again, the rationale for adding oral Cytoxan as a metronomic type of chemotherapy is to enhance the antiangiogenic effect. And of course, response rate goes up by a little bit. It was in the 20%, upper 20% range, but did not appear that the GI perf toxicities were higher. And then in our study, we saw, again, a comparable response rate to the GOG trial, and again, in a very platinum-resistant patient population. So this is a drug that, as a single agent, in two out of three studies looking at it as a single agent, really does have response. And I think that really represents a very important area of research for not just antibodies that target circulating or stationary targets, but also in small molecule inhibitors that target the various kinases.
You know, that single agent activity is striking in contrast to what's been seen in a lot of other tumors, where really it looks like most of the activity is combining with chemotherapy. I recently had the pleasure of interviewing Rakesh Jain from your neck mm-hmm. of the woods, who's
yes.
been very involved in the whole issue of, you know, how do these agents work. Any thoughts about what's going on with ovary versus these other tumors sort of biologically?
I think the rationale is that it's very VEGF dependent. And if you block it, you really can inhibit the growth. So I think VEGF and the whole antiangiogenic signaling pathways are very important in ovarian cancer.
Another thing that I was asking him about, and I've asked a bunch of other people about, is this concept of bevacizumab or anti-VEGF agents in terms of anti-ascites. Mm-hmm. And I hear mm-hmm. about these patients, I don't know how common they are, who have refractory advanced ascites that have good responses to Bev. Have you seen any patients like that?
Absolutely. And again, the ascites is VEGF driven. And once you remove it, you can have pretty remarkable drops in ascites. I think it's interesting when you're designing clinical trials, and everyone wants a piece of tissue when folks are on various clinical trials to see whether or not you're hitting your target. And there's this misconception out there that we'll be able to provide gobs of ascites to look at tumor cells within the ascites. But that's really a pattern that's changed over the past several years, where you really don't have patients anymore having refractory ascites or having this need for repetitive paracenteses on a weekly to every other week basis. That's becoming less common.
And why is that?
You know, it's interesting. I don't think we really know, but it may be just the way, it may be because we have drugs like Avastin, and I think a lot of women are receiving Avastin. We also have an armamentarium of a variety of chemotherapy drugs that are out there besides just platinum, besides paclitaxel or docetaxel, but other drugs that can be used in a variety of ways. And then certainly going back to previous chemotherapies, we can really keep women alive longer, not curing them with their disease, but allowing them to live with recurrence, but keeping away that ascites.
So you're saying that it's your impression that a fair number of people are receiving bevacizumab off study in the community?
For recurrent disease, yes.
Do you think that that's a justifiable or defensible strategy? Is it something that you do?
So I think I do use bevacizumab off study in the recurrent setting because, and again, I pick patients very carefully. I choose patients whom I think are going to have a low risk of GI perforation. I carefully counsel them about that risk of GI perforations. And I also will only pick patients whom I think will be checking blood pressures, who are not hypertensive, who have no risks of stroke, etc. So those large, very frightening side effects that can happen with bevacizumab, but of course can happen with any chemotherapy too. I mean, it certainly can happen with weekly paclitaxel too. I try to pick those patients to try to avoid those side effects.
And for patients with stage 3 or 4 disease who aren't eligible for any of the studies, who come to you and say, well, I've researched this, I'd like to get bevacizumab off study, how would you respond to that?
For newly diagnosed, no. I would not give bevacizumab off study.
Getting back to this ascites thing, is it your impression when you see it work that it's an anti-tumor effect or sort of a vascular effect or maybe both?
Well, clearly, I think that there definitely has to be an anti-cancer effect because you do drop away the ascites and usually concomitantly you'll see some reduction in the areas of solid tumor growth as well. You'll see decrease in peritoneal metastases. You may see some lymph nodes reduce in size. So I see your point. It's hard to know 100%, but I certainly think there's anti-cancer effect.
What have you observed in terms of how women tolerate bevacizumab in terms of hypertension, proteinuria, all the other things that we're used to looking for, sort of mm-hmm. what you would expect based on what we see in general?
I think that, well, again, I treat only predominantly GYN oncology patients. I certainly do see some breast cancer patients as well. And again, treating both of those, it does appear that both groups of patients are going to be at risk for developing hypertension, and it's a very serious side effect. It can happen just after they start. They can start the bevacizumab, and then within just a few weeks, have elevated blood pressures.
What we've heard, and I guess has been reported, is that in general, this is fairly easy to control. Is that your experience?
You know, it's interesting. It's not always that easy to control. I mean, certainly I've become a little bit better at using drugs like lisinopril to manage the hypertension. But every once in a while, someone will need to go on 2 or 3 different antihypertensives. And I definitely have to have a hypertension doc working aside to give me advice.
I want to go back into some of the trials that you were talking about, but just again, just sort of taking more of a macro point of view. You know, we started doing programs on ovarian cancer, I think about a year ago, and I got several emails from docs saying, you know, what else is new besides bevacizumab? All you're talking about is bevacizumab. Has anything else happened in the last 20 years in ovarian cancer or anything happening that looks as promising for the future? Anything else that's kind of similar interest out right now in terms of clinical
mm-hmm,
research?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that we will see more advancement in ovarian cancer as we get a better sense of the genetic changes that go along. So the basic science research is going to drive new drug development. And just like in breast cancer, where you have identification of targets that you can use drugs against, where they've, you know, HER2 positive breast cancer is a highly treatable cancer. We don't yet have that target in ovary cancer. And there are drugs that are looking at, again, the VEGFR, the VEGF receptors, in terms of blocking them and inhibiting them, PI3 kinase inhibitors, folic acid receptor inhibitors, I mean, these are all drugs that are being used in small phase 2 trials and are showing some promise.
Anything close enough that there's even discussion about the possibility of phase 3?
So currently in Europe, ICON 6 is going on. And ICON 6 is basically patients who have platinum-sensitive recurrence receive carboplatin, Taxol, or carboplatin, Taxol, plus a drug called cediranib or Rosentan. That's AZD2171. And that blocks VEGF receptors 1, 2, and 3. So that is a randomized phase 3 study that is placing into the armamentarium a biologic.
And you've done some work with that drug, haven't you?
Exactly. That's correct.
Can you talk a little bit about that and whether you think that maybe the studies might turn out positive?
So again, that data was presented at ASCO this year. We showed a clinical benefit rate of over 30%. So it's definitely an active drug. And how it will work in platinum-sensitive disease, how it will work in upfront cancer, it's a different drug than bevacizumab. Bevacizumab has a very long half-life. So bevacizumab can't really be used as a neoadjuvant drug pre-surgery, but AZD2171 or cediranib has a very short half-life. So it can be used, stopped, and then somebody can go to surgery. So it has more movability into different treatment realms.
You actually saw some responses with that agent.
We definitely did see responses, absolutely, yes.
What about side effects and toxicity?
So again, paralleling the bevacizumab experience, hypertension, fatigue, and then diarrhea. And we definitely see high TSHs. So we see the development of hypothyroidism or at least hypothyroid conditions in about a month. You'll see the TSH rise within a month.
And I guess I think that agent's being looked at in colon cancer and some other
Correct.
Tumors too.
And in lung cancer as well in Canada.
Right. You mentioned HER2 in terms of breast cancer, but HER2 has also been looked at in ovarian cancer. And again, you've done work on that with the agent pertuzumab. How would you summarize what we know about the issue of HER2 in ovarian cancer and specifically pertuzumab?
Mm-hmm. So HER2 is not overexpressed in ovarian cancer. So you have to screen a lot of cases to find the few cases that do overexpress HER2. And even in those patients, the responses are not that particularly robust. So Herceptin's not going to be a drug used in ovarian cancer. Pertuzumab, on the other hand, works in a different way. And pertuzumab, as opposed to blocking the HER2 signaling, blocks the dimerization site of HER2. So something like HER3 can't hook onto HER2. So there's a blockage there. So it blocks HER2, HER3 dimerization. So it works in a different way than Herceptin. And there have been 3 trials of pertuzumab. One is a single agent study that was published in the JCO a number of years ago. A GEM placebo versus GEM pertuzumab trial. And then thirdly, a European study, Roche-sponsored study in platinum-sensitive disease using a platinum-based chemotherapy regimen with or without pertuzumab. And I think we're learning more about pertuzumab, about how it works, and then potentially drilling down to a subset of patients where it might work better than others.
When you look at those data and anything else that's out there, what's the bottom line? I mean, is there activity with this drug?
So I think it's an uncompleted story. And I can't tell you all of the data about pertuzumab, but I think it probably will still be studied in ovarian cancer.
Do you feel that there's evidence that there's anti-tumor activity with the agent in any patients?
Right. So I think that it may be that, and again, this is an evolving story, but when you look at HER3 expression levels, so mRNA expression levels of HER3, that lower HER3 levels may predict for pertuzumab activity.
I saw that in that paper, and I didn't really understand what it meant. Just to be honest, low levels of HER3, what does that mean?
Okay, so what that means is that when you think about, it's nothing to do with protein expression levels. It all has to do with signaling through the HER2, HER3 heterodimer. So HER3 doesn't have a tyrosine kinase on it, so it needs to either bind to HER2 or HER1 so it can start to signal. It's got 6 docking sites on for PI3 kinase, So once it hooks on to HER2, it can become activated and then signal down the AKT pathway. So the rationale is that if you have low HER3 levels, that means that the signaling is on. It's on through HER2, HER3, because it downregulates HER3 expression. If you have high HER3 levels, it means that the cancer is not really working through HER2, HER3.
I'm curious, just sort of taking a step back, about some of the common questions that you receive from docs in practice about sort of day-to-day management of ovarian cancer.
I get a lot of questions about upfront chemotherapy, the use of intraperitoneal chemotherapy. Should we use it? What doses of cisplatin should be used? Should you give the Taxol over 24 hours versus 3 hours? Should you give the day 8 IP Taxol? I mean, there are a lot of questions around that regimen that I get. And I think institution to institution, there are different ways to use that GOG-172 regimen. It's not practiced uniformly across the U.S.
And what's your specific practice?
We follow to the T 172. So we bring patients into the hospital. We give them Taxol through a central line, give it over 24 hours at a dose of 135 milligrams per meter squared. And then on day 2, they get intraperitoneal cisplatinum at a dose of 100 milligrams per meter squared. They go home. We give them IV fluids as an outpatient. Then they come back a week later on day 8 and get a dose of IP Taxol at 60 milligrams per meter squared. And again, sometimes the Taxol dose is shortened from 24 hours down to 3 hours. The cisplatin may be dropped from 100 down to 75. So all these different permutations.
Any sense about what's going on in the community in that regard, and particularly in terms of IP therapy?
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. I think the take-up has been very slow. And I think it's a practice that if you're going to do, you have to do it often. It took us a good half a year or so to get the proper, not necessarily resources, but the plan in place about where our patients were treated. Because if you're getting intraperitoneal chemotherapy, you have to be in a private room. You need a bed. Sometimes you need to admit patients to the hospital. They need to come in for extra IV fluids. A lot of phone calls, a lot of questions that come in from patients. How do you warm the chemotherapy before putting it in? Do you use a pump to put it in? Do you just let the bag hang? There are all these issues that come up that the nurses have to develop policies and procedures around.
How much of a benefit do you think IP therapy is presenting to patients, and how much of a risk?
Mm-hmm. Certainly, if you look at GOG-172, the overall survival benefit's about 16 months, which is the best so far. If you think about GOG-111 that added Taxol to platinum, there was about a year improvement in overall survival. So to see a 16-month improvement in survival, you know, it's pretty significant. But certainly there are downsides to it as well. The toxicities are much greater. They're probably ameliorated a little bit by dropping the doses of cisplatin to 75, but again, that hasn't been tested in a randomized setting, so it can't be recommended uniformly for use. But certainly neuropathy increases, the degree of pancytopenia increases, nausea, vomiting, renal toxicities, not too much liver functions, but certainly with the cisplatinum, we mostly see increased nausea, vomiting, electrolyte problems, renal toxicities, and then the neuropathy. And it's interesting, I've definitely noticed that the neuropathy tends to happen once someone's completed the chemotherapy. So it's not like giving carbotaxol, where you can really follow that neuropathy, and then when someone develops it that's higher than a grade 2, you can start to adjust the dose of the chemotherapy drugs down. With the intraperitoneal regimen, I have patients 2 or 3 months later developing potentially severe neuropathy, and that's borne out in the quality of life assessments of patients, that their quality of life at 1 year for both groups, the non-IP and the IP group, are about the same. But the neuropathy is long-lasting, and that's harder to predict. So if anyone's certainly developing neuropathy on IP, I would definitely dose reduce them sooner rather than later.
How do you approach the issue of maintenance off study?
So maintenance off study, I think at this point, if you looked at all the trials, there's no evidence for maintenance, either Bev or paclitaxel or any trial at this point. There's an ongoing GOG study that looks at 6 cycles of carbotaxol and randomizes to one of 3 arms, nothing, IV taxol for 1 year, or Zyotac, so a pegylated paclitaxel. And again, that study will hopefully answer the question, not necessarily which taxane to use, but whether or not a taxane improves over nothing.
Can you talk a little bit about your approach to the patient with recurrent disease?
So a patient with recurrent disease certainly would think about different categories for treatment. So platinum sensitive versus platinum resistant, that's a very significant way to group patients. So if somebody's platinum resistant, so they have cancer growing within 6 months of completing a platinum-based chemotherapy, that puts them into a different group. If they're platinum sensitive, then you think about those patients if they're 6 to 12 months out from platinum or if they're more than a year. Certainly if they're more than a year, you have to think about surgery, whether or not bringing them back to the operating room, removing cancer, and then giving them more platinum is the best way. But certainly if they're over a year platinum sensitive, you would consider use of platinum. 6 to 12 months is a little bit harder. And I think at that point, it depends upon the patient, her prior toxicities, and what disease you're dealing with. Are you dealing with a Ca125 of 200 and her CT is negative and she feels well? Or are you dealing with somebody who has an impending bowel obstruction and can't eat? For those patients who are more symptomatic, clearly I would reuse a platinum and add it to something else. The Pfisterer paper that now led to the FDA approval of Carbo plus Gem in platinum-sensitive recurrence is certainly a regimen that can be used. Carboplatinum Taxol could be used. And in patients with platinum-resistant cancers, again, there are a number of chemotherapies, Doxil, Topotecan, clinical trials, all should be thought of for those patients.
Can you talk a little bit about the data that we have in terms of CarboGem and what your clinical experience is with it?
So in the Pfisterer paper, the patients who received the combination had a reduced dose of the carboplatinum. So they received carbo-AUC of 4, and then they received gemcitabine, 1,000 milligrams per meter squared on day 1 and day 8. And that, from a myelosuppressive viewpoint, is certainly more, and that was definitely noted in the paper, that the degree of myelosuppression was higher than the single-agent carboplatinum. So certainly an active regimen. The degree of progression-free survival improvement, obviously we would like it always to be longer, but I think if you're looking at wanting to bring somebody out of trouble, look for responses. 2 drugs always give better response rates than 1 drug.
Any other side effects, toxicity issues other than myelosuppression?
So with the gemcitabine, there can be rashes. There can be pulmonary toxicity. Anytime you reuse carboplatinum, we're seeing the incidence of hypersensitivity reactions. We've seen about 30% risk for all of our patients who are retreated with carboplatinum. So that's certainly something to think about too.
How do you approach those patients?
Well, I have the pleasure of working with a wonderful allergist at the Brigham, Mariana Castells, and she skin tests patients for carboplatinum, and if they're positive, she desensitizes them to carboplatinum using a paradigm very similar to if she was going to desensitize to penicillin or to aspirin.
And how long does that take?
It takes about a day.
Really?
Yeah.
And I guess you all seem to be publishing, you know, all kinds of stuff about different drugs and hypersensitivity. You're like the hypersensitivity chemo capital of the world.
It's all Mariana.
Any other common situations in ovarian cancer where the hypersensitivity issue comes up?
It certainly comes up with Taxol. Can come up with Taxol up front. It can come up when you reuse paclitaxel. Just had a patient the other day who had a diagnosis of peritoneal cancer about 4 years ago, had a recurrence, gave her carbotaxel, first dose of Taxol, huge reaction, turned bright red, dropped her O2 sat. So something always to think about when either using these drugs up front or reusing them, because they can be life-threatening situations.
So what's the approach then to a patient who has that kind of reaction to Taxol?
That sort of a reaction, if she really turns bright red, is in distress, either has hypertension or hypotension, may drop her O2 sat, those patients we desensitize. The patients we don't, who we would retry with Taxol again, if they had a little bit of back pain, a much less severe reaction.
Now, is this presumably to the Taxol or to the Cremafor?
You know, it's really hard to know.
Has NAB paclitaxel been used in ovarian?
My colleague, Dr. Castells, will be doing a clinical trial which will look at NAB or Abraxane in patients who have had Taxol reactions, but that's a very good point. I think one has to use caution just using it, but we're certainly going to study that.
What about in the platinum refractory situation? Can you talk about sort of your clinical approach to these patients and how you decide on one path versus another?
So for patients who have platinum-resistant disease where they're no longer showing responses to platinum, then I think there, as I said, are several single-agent drugs. And again, this would also be an excellent time, as long as they're not too heavily pretreated, to go on a clinical trial. And this is also the time that one could consider bevacizumab, especially if they're demonstrating that this cancer is a chemotherapy-resistant tumor. And again, those patients are at low risk for the toxicities. This is a time that one could consider using Bev.
And when you do that, is it usually single agent?
I usually use single agent, correct.
I'm assuming that those patients do well in terms of quality of life and side effects.
We haven't necessarily measured quality of life on these patients, but I think if they certainly do develop significant toxicities, they'll come right off.
I guess the thing I'm thinking about is when I think about Bev, I don't think so much about acute side effects that you see with cytotoxics in terms of being an antibody. Mm-hmm. Is that your impression that the patient...
That's correct. It's more the long-term side effects like hypertension, mostly hypertension, very little fatigue. And if they do well on the drug, they usually do well on the drug.
You mentioned liposomal doxorubicin and topotecan as agents that you often use in this situation. What's your experience with those?
So Doxil is a very straightforward drug, has, I think, a very pretty well delineated toxicity profile. I personally do not use the FDA dose. We use a dose of 40 milligrams per meter squared. I think that is a standard of care around the U.S. We even talked about it at the GOG meetings this weekend, where the higher dose, although sometimes having to be used in clinical trials because it is the FDA-approved dose, but off-study, dropping it to 40 makes it more tolerable for patients in terms of the rash. Most of the times when you use a lower dose, the palmar plantar rash, or it's not necessarily palmar plantar, it can be whole body rash too, is typically manageable. And if it does get to be a problem, one can dose reduce or stretch out the time between cycles.
How do you manage it?
Certainly if it's a grade 2 or higher rash, so it's starting to bother patients, I would drop the dose down from 40 to probably 32 milligrams per meter squared.
Any other management issues in terms of local therapies?
So local therapy is, it really depends upon the type of rash. I mean, certainly telling patients to put cream on it, so if they have a dry rash, having them put cream on it so it's not that painful for them. Sometimes it's itchy, and then sometimes Benadryl cream works. We use a drug called Biafine. Again, it's an emollient, so it helps moisturize the skin. And certainly telling them to stay out of warm places and hot tubs and hot showers can make a difference.
You talked about the issue of, you know, looking at new targets and translational work, et cetera. And of course, that's something that's happening in every part of medical oncology right now. Mm-hmm. How do you see that happening in ovarian cancer? Is it happening? And what are some of the targets that you think are going to be most promising to go after?
There are a number of different drugs that are out there that do target different molecules. There are very interesting set of drugs that work around a BRCA mutation. They're called PARP inhibitors. Really exciting data presented at ASCO by Stan Kay's group looking at a drug called AZD2281. And this is a drug that's called a PARP inhibitor. PARP is an enzyme that essentially helps repair DNA when the BRCA protein is not functioning or not present. So it's kind of a workaround for a mutated BRCA1 or 2 gene. So the response is, you know, we've been participating on trials using PARP inhibitors, the same drug, and others to come, but they're really impressive drugs. They're mostly oral. This drug that was presented at ASCO is an oral drug, and response rates of, you know, over 60% in patients with a platinum-sensitive recurrence.
What about side effects and toxicity?
Yeah. So the side effects of PARP inhibitors, because it's an oral drug, have some nausea, some drop in blood counts, and that's about it. very few side effects to these drugs.
What's sort of the next step in terms of development of this agent or other similar agents?
There are going to be a number of different PARP inhibitors on the market, but it'll be in distinguishing them and how well they work in different patient populations. So, for example, the BRCA deficient patient, so whether or not she has a germline mutation, or intratumorally, the patient has an abnormal BRCA gene. So per patient, that she may not have a germline mutation, but there's something about the BRCA protein is just deficient or not working in her particular cancer.
How often does that happen?
Well, it's not certain, but it may be up to 30-40% of the time. And you can see this. You can see patients who have recurrences, but they definitely do not have a BRCA mutation, but their cancer keeps responding to successive rechallenges with platinum, and they go through long periods of remission. So something different about those patients than somebody who gets carboplatin, recurs within 2 or 3 months, then gets Doxil, then recurs very shortly. So there's something different in how that cancer cell recognizes platinum and maybe could be a paradigm for other chemotherapies. But there's something about platinum and potentially how the cell is able to recognize it.
Do we know, like, overall, roughly, what fraction of ovarian cancer is BRCA-related?
It's about 5 to 10%.
But you're saying that maybe there's some additional...
Oh, BRCA-related,
I see. Well, in the BRCA, you're saying 5 to 10%.
Germline mutations,
right, germline,
about 5%.
But you're saying maybe there's a whole other group where...
That's correct. That's where these drugs may be used. And again, they can also enhance DNA damaging agents. So they're being used with drugs like temozolomide for brain tumors. They're being combined with other drugs that might damage DNA and then allow that workaround from happening.
Anything new in terms of trying to get translational information in ovarian cancer, particularly in terms of where you might look, circulating tumor cells, acidic cells, anything that looks exciting to you?
Circulating tumor cells would certainly be a very fascinating, easy way to get a snapshot of the tumor. I mean, I think the work that was just published in the New England Journal of Medicine was fascinating, and we're looking at that. A lot of groups are looking at that. Nothing quite yet nailed down, because you would need to prove that the circulating tumor is really tumor, and it really matches the bulk of the cancer that's present in the patient.
And I know you're talking about the work, I guess Tom Lynch is involved
with
that. Matter of fact, Tom was our co-chair for a lung cancer think tank, and we were asked, that was a really incredible paper. Is that technology being looked at with ovarian? I know it's being looked at with a lot of different tumors.
It's interesting, because it seems like different tumors cause more tumor cells to be circulating. So breast cancer, just by its nature, you know, it's a hematologically disseminated tumor. So you do find a lot of circulating tumor cells in breast cancer patients. It's been looked at in ovarian cancer patients, and we've looked at it, but we don't usually find that many circulating tumor cells. They're not gobs of them. There may be 5, there may be 4. And certainly if you could lab-wise make those cells more, then I think we've got something. But they're just fewer in the patients with ovary cancer. I think there are a lot of issues in ovary cancer that are still not well defined, such as the patient who has an elevated CA125 marker, and should you treat her or not treat her? And I've certainly seen treatment go both ways. Maybe you have a patient, you know, again, patients follow their markers very carefully, and if it's 5 when it's plateaued at the completion of therapy and it goes to 10 and then it goes to 15, I mean, that probably does represent recurrence. But if you did a CT or if you did a PET scan, would you treat those patients if everything was negative? And the answer is probably not. I mean, I think there's no benefit in treating a marker that's slowly rising. I mean, again, that would be perfect per protocol. But unfortunately, most protocols use Rustin criteria, and you need to be twice normal. So you need to be at least 70. Most patients won't wait till 70 to get treated. Even if it doubles within the normal range, that causes a lot of concern. So that's an open field where we don't quite know what's the best thing to do. Should we treat patients who are completely asymptomatic, who have very small amounts of disease or no disease, or should we start to wait for patients to have a little bit more tumor, but certainly before they've gotten symptoms? Once they've gotten symptoms, the drugs will probably work less well, because a lot of our drugs have response rates between 10 and 20%.
What's your general clinical approach to people who only have a marker?
If it's elevated beyond 70, so making them Rustin criteria eligible, we have clinical trials open.
What about off protocol?
I would watch carefully. If they had no evidence of disease on CT, what I typically do, we'll put them on something like an aromatase inhibitor.
Have you seen responses?
I've seen drops in CA125s on aromatase inhibitors, yes.
Huh. What about the endocrine loop in ovarian cancer? What evidence do we have that endocrine therapy actually works?
So it's obviously different than in breast cancer, where the presence of estrogen receptor, overexpression of the estrogen receptor, can really give you robust clinical responses. If you look, the majority of ovary cancers definitely have estrogen receptor associated with them, so they'll be positive. But it's different than in breast cancer. You can use tamoxifen and use Arimidex or Femara, whatever AI you want to use. And certainly you would not see necessarily frank responses, but you could see stabilization of disease. You could see a marker stop rising or even drop down slightly. So that's something to give to patients who do have a rising marker, but no evidence of measurable disease. And it's potentially safer than tamoxifen because tamoxifen does have that theoretical risk of a clot. And our patients with ovary cancer who are recurrent definitely have a higher risk of blood clots. They're more hypercoagulable.
So it sounds like in a situation with an asymptomatic patient and nothing to palliate that you're trying to avoid introducing toxicity.
Exactly.
Any problems with arthralgias with the AIs has been seen a lot with breast cancer?
Mm-hmm. I think that our patients are not on them long enough for them to experience the arthralgias, but certainly if somebody is on it long enough, so greater than 6 months or so, absolutely. You see those same arthralgias at the CM breast cancer.